Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in February of 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, titled, Canada is taking Trump seriously and personally. Sometimes sporting events really are bigger than the game itself. By Ken Dryden. Last Saturday, I was in Montreal for the Canada-U.S. hockey game in the Four Nations Cup. I knew I needed to be there. A few nights later, I was at home in front of our TV for the final game, which Canada won 3-2 in overtime. I watched every moment, from before the game began to after it ended. I almost never do that. Those games, I knew, were going to say something about Canadian players, about Canadian fans, about Canada. Maybe something about the United States, too. I didn't know what. Sports can tell big stories. I was one of two goalies for Canada in the Canada-Soviet Union series in 1972, the first international best-against-best hockey series. Until that moment, professional players from the NHL were not eligible to compete in the amateur-only Olympic Games or World Championships. Canada was where hockey originated, where all of the best players in the world were born and developed. To the total annoyance of Canadians, year after year, the Soviet Union, not Canada, became known as world champions. The 1972 showdown was 8 games, 4 in Canada, 4 in Moscow. Everyone, the Canadian players and fans, even the Soviet players and fans, and the experts from both countries knew that Canada would win decisively, likely all 8 games, and by big scores. In Game 1 in Montreal, the Soviets won 7-3. Imagine the reaction all across Canada. Then multiply that by 10. Instantly, the stakes changed. Something deeper than hockey pride was on the line. We were the best in the world when it came to hockey. The rest of the world didn't think about Canada that way when it came to too many other things. Now we had lost. What did that say about us? About Canada? About Canadians? The next 7 games would decide. These were the stakes. We left Canada trailing 2-1 with 1 game tied. We lost the first game in Moscow. The series was all but over. Then we won the next 2 games, leaving it to 1 final game. In 1972, not many North Americans traveled to Europe. Almost none went to Moscow. 3,000 Canadians were in that arena. They were there because somehow they knew they had to be there. For the last game on a Thursday, played entirely during work and school hours all across the country, 16 million out of Canada's population of 22 million people watched. Behind 2 goals to start the 3rd period, we tied the game, then won it, and the series, with 34 seconds remaining. I felt immense excitement. I felt even more immense relief. In that series, Canadians discovered a depth of feeling for their country that they hadn't known was there. In 1980, I was the other person in the Olympics booth in Lake Placid, New York, when the U.S. beat the Soviets and won the gold medal. When Al Michaels said, "Do you believe in miracles?" "Yes," I said, "unbelievable." At the beginning of the Olympics for the U.S., there were no stakes. The team was made up almost entirely of college kids. The Soviets, at the time, were the best team in the world. Even after the U.S. team won some early games, their players seemed on a roll to enjoy, not to be taken seriously. Then they beat the Soviets, and 2 days later defeated Finland to win the gold. This was not a good time for the U.S. in the world. Among other problems and conflicts, Iran was holding 52 Americans hostage in Tehran. Weeks passed. The U.S. seemed powerless to get them back. Unbeknownst to all but a few, 6 of the hostages, all American diplomats, had escaped and were being hidden in the Canadian embassy. The Canadians sheltered the diplomats for months and eventually helped them escape. The news that the diplomats had made it safely out of Iran came just before the Lake Placid Games began. Everywhere I went around the village, Americans came up to me and said, "Thank you, Canada," as if they were otherwise friendless in the world. In 1980, hockey was not a major sport in the U.S., and so Americans had no expectation or even hope of winning against the Soviets. What they did have at stake in 1980 was the Cold War. That they had to win. The hockey team's victory in Lake Placid felt like part of this bigger fight. It fit the story Americans wanted to tell about themselves, and although hockey was a fairly minor sport, 45 years later, the Miracle on Ice remains their favorite patriotic sports moment. Now to today. Now to the Four Nations Cup. Being Canadian these past few months hasn't been a lot of fun. The threat and now the coming reality of the high tariffs on Canadian goods exported to the U.S., and the disruptions and dislocations, known and unknown, that these tariffs will cause, is never out of mind. Even more difficult in the day-to-day is Donald Trump's relentless and insulting commentary. Canada as the U.S.'s 51st state, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau as Governor Trudeau, the U.S. using economic force to annex Canada, its nearest ally and inescapable geographical fact of life. It's the kind of trolling that Trump does to everyone, to every country, whenever he wants to, because as president of the most powerful nation on earth, he knows he can. He loves to watch the weak wobble and cringe, and those who think they're strong discover they're not. Na 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 na. It sets a tone. It lets everyone know who's boss. It's what he'd done all his life in business. And although at a boardroom table he wasn't always the guy with the deepest pockets, in the Oval Office of the United States of America, he knows he is. Being Donald Trump got him elected, but being president is what allows him to be Donald Trump. On November 5th, nobody had as much at stake in the election's result as he did. He needed to win to hold the world's highest office, to avoid lawsuits and prison time. He needed to win to be him. It's been amazing to watch world leaders of proud, historically significant countries, kings in their own domain, suck up to Donald Trump, to see billionaires and business titans who know how the game is played, cater to political authority in public, play hardball in private, who reside proudly and smugly above and beyond politics, fold like a cheap suit. And later, when they do respond, because prime ministers, presidents, and CEOs eventually have to say something, their words sound so lame. There's not a snowball's chance in hell that Canada would become part of the United States, Trudeau said. By answering at all, you end up making any slur sound slightly, disturbingly legitimate, and you make yourself look weak. How would Americans react if a president or prime minister of another country said the same about their president? That he's crooked, crazy, a lunatic, a loser? That he's the worst president in the history of the world? That their country is just another failed empire in its final death throes? That both president and country are a disgrace, and everyone knows it? Probably not well. But what do you do? What do the decision makers in other countries do? What do average Canadians, average Panamanians and Danes? What do ordinary people anywhere do? That's why I needed to be at that game in Montreal. 30 years earlier, in 1995, on the weekend before Quebec's second referendum on independence, my family and I went to Montreal to wander the city, to try to sense what Quebecers were feeling, but mostly just to be there. On a Saturday night, we went to a Montreal Canadiens game. We wanted to be there for the singing of O Canada. The next day, a reporter for an English-language newspaper wrote that it was the loudest he had ever heard the anthem sung at a game. What he didn't notice was that 10,000 people sang their hearts out, and 10,000 people were silent. Last Saturday in Montreal, the arena was filled with fans in red and white Canada jerseys. The NHL and the NHL Players Association, which had organized the event, did what organizers do. They asked the fans to be respectful of both teams during the anthems. The fans decided not to be managed. They booed the Star Spangled Banner loudly. They were not booing the American players. They were booing Donald Trump. Why shouldn't he know how they felt? Why shouldn't Americans know? How else would they know? 5 nights later in Boston at the final game, the fans booed O Canada, but not very loudly. The game was a classic. The two best teams in the world. Canada, the heart and soul, conscience and bedrock of the game. The U.S. in its development and growth, the great story in hockey in the past 30 years. Both teams played as well as they'd ever played. Their great stars played like great stars. Some other players discovered in themselves something even they didn't know was there. The U.S. could have won. The team was good enough to win. Canada won because of Connor McDavid, Nathan MacKinnon, and Sidney Crosby, and for the same reason Canada won against the Soviets in 1972. Everybody, every country has something inside them that is fundamental, that matters so much that it's non-negotiable, that's deeply, deeply personal, something that if threatened, you'd do anything to protect, and keep on doing it until it's done, even if it seems to others to make no sense, even if it seems stupid. This is how wars start. For Panama, some things are fundamental. For Denmark, China, Russia, Germany, Ukraine, Canada, for everyone, it's the same. And when you get pushed too far, too much, you rediscover what that fundamental is. Poke the bear and you find out there's more in the bear than you know, than even the bear knows. For Canada and these other countries, you don't poke back against Donald Trump. You don't troll a troll. You look into yourselves and find again what makes you special, why you matter to yourselves, to the world, and knowing that is you, with that as your pride and backbone, you fight back. The U.S. has its own fights. It faces these same questions. What is fundamental to America? Greatness? Maybe. But greatness depends on the needs of a country and the needs of the world at that particular moment and time, and being great in the ways that are needed. These next 4 years will not be easy for anyone, and they will be perhaps especially difficult for the United States. As for that 51st state crap, knock it off. It's beneath you. For Donald Trump, everything is a transaction. You look to make a deal. You push and shove, scratch and claw. You do whatever it takes. And if that doesn't work, you do some more, until at some point you walk away and make another deal. It's just business. Only some things aren't business. Every so often, Canadians are defiantly not American. They will need to be much more than that in the next 4 years. Canadians will need to be defiantly Canadian. Canada won in 1972 and again last week because winning was about more than business. It was personal. That's the end of the article. The author, Ken Dryden, was a goaltender for the Montreal Canadiens in the 1970s, during which time the team won 6 Stanley Cups. He's a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame, was a member of the Canadian Parliament, and a cabinet minister, and is the author of several books. The name of his article was Canada is Taking Trump Seriously and Personally. This next article comes to us from the health section. The title is COVID Broke the Rules of Virus Evolution. Why did this coronavirus change faster than scientists expected? By Sarah Shang. In the early, uncertain days of the coronavirus pandemic, scientists delivered one comforting pronouncement. The virus that caused COVID mutates rather slowly. If that remained true, the virus would not change much to become more dangerous soon, and any vaccine could provide years of durable protection. What actually happened was that the SARS-CoV-2 began mutating quickly, first to be more transmissible, and then to evade our immunity, causing breakthrough infections and reinfections. 5 years and an alphanumeric soup of variants later, most of us have gotten COVID at least once. The vaccine is still being updated to match new circulating variants, and the virus itself is still changing. In truth, scientists were both right and wrong about the speed at which SARS-CoV-2 mutates. The rate of mutations as this virus jumps from person to person is indeed unimpressive. But scientists are not aware of a second accelerated evolutionary track. When SARS-CoV-2 infects a single immunocompromised patient, it can persist for months, accumulating countless mutations in that time. And if we are unlucky, that highly mutated virus might spread to others. This is the likely origin of Omicron, which appeared in fall 2021 with more than 50 mutations, an astounding evolutionary leap. Omicron looked like it had achieved 4 or 5 years' worth of expected evolution in just months. Jesse Bloom, who studies viral evolution at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, told me at the time, "These mutations enabled Omicron to cause a massive wave of infections, even among the vaccinated." Scientists now believe that chronic infections in immunocompromised patients are a key driver of variants in Omicron and beyond. Even as COVID surveillance has faded in urgency, researchers are watching chronic infections for signs of what's to come. In retrospect, clues were there from the beginning. At the start of the pandemic, researchers in New York, including Harm van Beckel, a geneticist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, began sequencing viruses from cancer patients who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 in March and April 2020, and then kept testing positive for up to 2 months. The patients couldn't clear the virus because their immune systems had been weakened by disease and by cancer treatments they received. The study, published in December 2020, concluded that immunocompromised patients with COVID might need long isolation periods, lest they unwittingly spread the virus. These chronic infections in people who are immunocompromised are distinct from long COVID, which doesn't necessarily involve continual shedding of virus. That same month, a reprint from a group led by Ravindra Gupta in the UK connected more of the dots. Gupta and his colleagues had found an immunocompromised patient with a lingering infection who was treated with antibodies from COVID survivors, only for the virus to acquire curious new mutations. Two mutations in particular gave the virus a slight edge in infectivity and antibody evasion. An immunocompromised host, the authors suggested, could provide the ideal viral training ground. A weakened immune system cannot wipe out the virus, but can put up just enough defense for the virus to learn its tricks. In this case, the infused antibodies from COVID survivors likely contributed to whatever defenses the patient himself had, but even together, they were not enough to completely clear the infection. The virus from that particular patient probably didn't spread far, if at all. Most do not. But countless chronic infections all around the world subjecting the virus to similar immune defenses could ultimately lead to the same battle-tested mutations showing up over and over again. Indeed, mutations similar to the two in the UK patient soon showed up in variants such as Alpha and Omicron that did sweep around the world, Gupta told me recently. And in 2021, multiple alarming variants were found to have a different mutation that researchers in New York first observed in immunocompromised patients way back at the beginning of the pandemic. Researchers at Mount Sinai, led by Van Beckel and Viviana Simon, did match a minor variant from an immunocompromised patient to other infections in the New York City area, though it didn't seem to spread much beyond that. None of the more notorious COVID variants has been directly traced to a single immunocompromised patient, but indirect evidence has accumulated over time that many variants do develop this way. Chronic infections, scientists have now observed over and over, create a distinct pattern of mutations, an overabundance of changes in the spike protein, which helps penetrate human cells, but not in the rest of the virus. This pattern is clearly found in both BA.1 and BA.2 versions of Omicron, as well as the variant that gave rise to JN.1, which drove last winter's COVID surge. Bloom now says he has very high confidence that these variants came from chronic infections. The evidence is not as clear with other variants, he told me, but they could very well have evolved in the same way. Long before COVID, Bloom had tracked the evolution of influenza during chronic infections in 4 immunocompromised patients. Some mutations in these patients eventually showed up in the seasonal flu. I wrote about the study when it was published in 2017, intrigued by the possibility that chronic infections could predict changes in flu from year to year. At the time, this was quite a novel idea. Flu and COVID evolution do differ in important ways, but chronic COVID infections, too, are now being examined as harbingers of the future. Those will actually teach us a lot about the future tricks SARS-CoV-2 will come up with, says Simon, a microbiologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. To discover what those might be, she and Van Beckel are now leading a research project to create better tools for sequencing chronic infections and to better understand which immunocompromised patients are most at risk for carrying them. What they find could be a preview for the future of COVID. That ends the article. The title was COVID Broke the Rules of Virus Evolution by Atlantic staff writer Sarah Shang. I'll take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I'm reading articles that were published in February of 2025 in the online edition of the Atlantic. The next article is titled, "The Doge Project Will Backfire. Trump's War on Public Employees is Bad for All of Us," by Donald Moynihan. President Donald Trump and his billionaire advisor Elon Musk justify just dismantling the civil service as cost-cutting. The federal government has billions and billions of dollars in waste, fraud, and abuse, Trump claimed earlier this month, and Musk has complained about a staggering amount of waste of taxpayer money. Their actions, a barrage of executive orders, memos, layoffs, and attempts to unilaterally eliminate entire agencies, have sparked outrage. But Musk sees that only as proof of their achievements. They wouldn't be complaining so much if we weren't doing something useful. For all of Trump's and Musk's talk of efficiency, their policies will likely slow down the government. The state needs capacity to perform core tasks, such as collecting revenue, taking care of veterans, tracking weather, and ensuring that travel, medicine, food, and workplaces are safe. But Trump seems intent on pushing more employees to leave and making the civil service more political and an even less inviting job option. He bullies federal employees, labeling them as crooked, and likening their removal to getting rid of all the cancer. A smaller, terrified, and politicized public workforce will not be an effective one. To start, let's dispense with the notion that the government is too big. It is not. As a share of the workforce, federal employment has declined in the past several decades. Civilian employees represent about 1.5% of the population and account for less than 7% of total government spending. According to the nonpartisan Partnership for Public Service, 7 out of 10 civilian employees work in organizations that deal with national security, including departments such as Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security, that the public supports. The reality is that the federal government has long faced a human capital crisis. Since 2001, the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office has classified human capital management, the number of people who are successfully recruited to fill skill positions, as an area of high risk for the federal government. The workforce is older than the private sector, and the federal government already has a hard time hiring people. If the federal government should, then, rightly be focused on hiring, it is quite obviously doing the opposite. But the manner in which the Trump administration and DOGE are forcing workers out will only compound the error. 10,000 USAID employees, for example, were recently placed on administrative leave. Employees on leave must still be paid, so little money will be saved in the short run. And if they're rehired, the agencies will have to incur the costs that resulted from the disruption in their work. The USAID Inspector General's office has said that the agency has almost entirely lost its ability to track $8.2 billion in unspent aid. The Inspector General was fired the day after his office made that announcement. Projects such as drug trials and medical treatments have been abandoned. Mass layoffs of probationary employees have also begun to devastate some agencies. Public sector workforce motivation is not just about material needs. It arises from a sense of being involved in a team, actively taking on important public goals. Senior employees will watch as those they recruited are shown the door, underlining the sense that their work is considered unimportant. And if no new employees are added, senior employees might conclude that they don't really need to show up for work either. Trump's federal workforce plans make the conditions of employment generally less appealing. Take his executive order ending remote work for all federal employees. As Musk and his former Doge co-leader, Vivek Ramaswamy, explained in the Wall Street Journal, a one-size-fits-all back-to-office policy will generate a wave of voluntary terminations that we welcome. Trump has also promised to reassign employees from the D.C. region, even though prior efforts resulted in mass exits, and more than 8 out of 10 federal employees are already outside the D.C. area. The Trump administration has created a toxic work environment. I've spent 25 years studying public administration and have never seen anything like the deep sense of dread that federal employees are now experiencing. I spoke with workers who feared reprisal if their names were published. One told me that there's an eerie mood in the Census Bureau office. No one can openly discuss anything. Another civil servant said that people who've worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office for decades are afraid and can't believe what's happening. Trump's attempts to bend nonpartisan federal employees to his political objectives will further diminish the bureaucracy's ability to perform necessary tasks. On his first day in office, Trump reinstated Schedule F, an executive order from his first term that makes it easier to fire tens of thousands of career civil servants. With fewer job protections, employees may be less willing to speak up and correct information that conflicts with Trump's agenda. Those who do could be replaced by more political and less experienced workers. Trump also signed a memo saying that the senior executive service, the most senior career employees, must serve at the pleasure of the president. Some experts view this language as an attempt to turn these high-level workers into at-will political employees who could be fired by the president for any reason, regardless of their performance. One Department of Justice General Counsel, who had been promoted to the senior executive service under Trump, was dismissed despite outstanding performance evaluations. At the same time, the Office of Personnel Management has opened the door for even more Trump loyalists by removing limitations on the number of so-called Schedule C political appointees in government. Nothing is more emblematic of how Trump is reshaping the government than what is happening in the Office of Personnel Management. In his first term, Trump tried and failed to eliminate the agency. In his second term, Musk affiliates, including a staffer who reportedly finished high school in 2024, took over, locking out career civil servants from access to data. They created a government-wide email list with a parallel server and used it to send federal employees a deferred resignation offer that has no basis in law. Congress has identified ways to provide buyouts, or more precisely, voluntary separation incentives, but OPM did not use this authority and instead simply told employees they could resign and continue getting paid until September. Although the agency is tasked with recruiting government workers, its website urged them to move from lower productivity jobs in the public sector to higher productivity jobs in the private sector. Their exit will be our loss. We rely on public employees every day, usually not noticing how they make our lives better. The cost of dismantling agencies, dramatically politicizing state capacity, and demeaning the idea of public service will still be counted long after Trump has departed the scene. That completes the article. The author, Donald Moynihan, is the Harris Family Professor at the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. He publishes the blog, Can We Still Govern? The title of his article was The DOGE Project Will Backfire. The next article is titled A Man Who Actually Stands Up to Trump. Zelensky's very presence reprimands everyone who surrendered to Trump, by Franklin Foyer. The scene in Kiev earlier this month recalled the darkest days of oligarchic rule. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent slipped a piece of paper across the table to Volodymyr Zelensky. "You really need to sign this," Bessent told the Ukrainian president, according to the Wall Street Journal. The document was a deal to give the United States the rights to hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Ukraine's minerals. When Zelensky said that he needed time to consider the proposal, Bessent pushed the paper closer to him and warned that people back in Washington would be very upset. The Trump administration was operating in the old spirit of the kleptocrats who built fortunes in Ukraine and Russia at the dawn of the post-communist era, wielding veiled threats to bully the nation's leader into hastily handing over precious resources in a shady deal. To Zelensky's credit, he did his best to resist Bessent's pressure. "I can't sell our state," he explained. It was as if he had actually internalized the message that American diplomats from the Bush, Obama, and Biden administrations had attempted to drum in to Ukraine's collective psyche. Ukraine's democracy depends on it resisting powerful business interests that seek to plunder its wealth on terms highly unfavorable to the Ukrainian public. Zelensky's willingness to stand up to President Donald Trump, holding true to American values in the face of American intimidation, was a perverse trading of places. The moment recalls another episode in Ukraine's recent past. 3 years ago today, Russian troops streamed across the nation's borders. Assassins descended on the capital in search of its president. Citizens decamped to the subways in search of shelter. Western intelligence agencies predicted Ukraine's imminent demise. And in that moment of despair, Zelensky strode out into the empty streets of Kiev, into the dark of night, to record a video reassuring the world, "We are still here." In those initial days of the war, Zelensky began to pose as a defender of liberalism, fighting on behalf of global democracy. Whether he actually meant it wasn't clear. Before the war, his record of curbing corruption was spotty at best. With his political inexperience and his strange unwillingness to prepare his country against the looming Russian threat, the former comic actor hardly had the makings of a sturdy bulwark against autocracy. But he became one in the face of an unrelenting assault. Having preserved his nation's independence, however, he's now facing not one, but two of the world's most powerful illiberal leaders, conspiring in tandem. For reasons both petty and pecuniary, Trump seems intent on fulfilling Russian President Vladimir Putin's goal of crushing Ukrainian sovereignty. The American president is pressing for Russia's favored resolution to the war, without even allowing Zelensky a seat at the negotiating table. And the resource deal he's pursuing amounts to World War I-style reparations, but extracted from the victim of aggression. It would force the Ukrainians to hand over the wealth beneath their ground, without any guarantee of their security in exchange. The extortion that Trump proposes would deny Ukraine any possibility of recovering economically and consign its people to a state of servitude. In this new moment of crisis, Zelensky is reverting to the role he played in the war's earliest days. Confronted with blunt force, he's bravely resisting. Squaring up to the bully, he accused Trump of swimming in disinformation. Despite all the pressure the United States has applied on him to accede to the mineral deal, he's refused. Yesterday, he said, "I am not signing something that 10 generations of Ukrainians will have to repay." Knowing that Trump will never set aside his personal animosity toward him, he offered to resign in exchange for a Western security guarantee. He has resisted the administration's demands, despite the fact that he has no leverage in his dealings with the U.S., other than moral suasion and a limited ability to get in Trump's way. Ukraine's military is entirely dependent on American arms, and its European allies can do almost nothing at this late date to fill the void. In the end, given Ukraine's tenuous existence, Zelensky might have little choice but to accept whatever Trump imposes, but at least he's shown that there's a course other than immediate surrender. Once upon a time, the United States poured diplomatic resources and military aid into Ukraine so that it wouldn't descend into Russian-style autocracy. Now it's the United States that's headed in that direction. In the form of Elon Musk, an oligarch has captured the power of the American government, through which he can invisibly advance his own interests. The president is attempting to intimidate and sue the media into complying with the administration's agenda. The norms of the administrative state have been shattered so that Trump can reward cronies and punish enemies. And in the most literal sense, the United States is collaborating with Russian autocracy so that the foreign policies of the two regimes are more closely aligned. American institutions have largely faltered amid Trump's assault, and European allies have aimlessly panicked. But Zelensky's very presence reprimands the West for its futile opposition. His resoluteness shames Republicans, who once admired him as a latter-day Winston Churchill, for their own abject capitulation. Although he arguably has more to lose from a Trump administration than anyone on the planet, he's kept pushing back, with resourcefulness that recalls Ukraine's guerrilla tactics immediately after the Russian invasion. When the history of the era is written, Zelensky will be seen as the global leader of the anti-authoritarian resistance, who refused to accept the terms that the powerful sought to impose on his nation. he clarified the terms of the struggle with his heroic example. He reminds despairing liberals, "We are still here." That completes the article. The title was "A Man Who Actually Stands Up to Trump" by Atlantic staff writer Franklin Foer. This next article is titled "Brazil Stood Up for Its Democracy. Why Didn't the U.S.?" Jair Bolsonaro was made to answer for trying to overturn an election by Quico Toro. For years now, politics in Brazil have been the funhouse mirror version of those in the United States. The dynamic was never plainer than it became last week, when Brazilian prosecutors formally charged the far-right former president, Jair Bolsonaro, along with 33 co-conspirators, with crimes connected to a sprawling plan to overthrow the nation's democracy and hang on to power after losing an election in October of 2022. That the charges against Bolsonaro sound familiar to Americans is no coincidence. Bolsonaro consulted with figures in Donald Trump's orbit in pursuit of his election denial strategy. But the indictment against Bolsonaro suggests that the Brazilian leader went much further than Trump did, allegedly bringing high-ranking military officers into a coup plot and signing off on a plan to have prominent political opponents murdered. In this, as in so many things, Bolsonaro comes across as a cruder, more thuggish version of his northern doppelganger. Trump calculated shrewdly to try to retain his electoral viability after his January 6th defeat. Bolsonaro seems to have lacked that impulse control. He attempted so violent a power grab that the institutional immune system tasked with protecting Brazil's democracy was shocked into overdrive. The distortion in the mirror is most pronounced with regard to this institutional response. While American prosecutors languidly dotted I's and crossed T's, Brazil's institution seems to understand early on that they faced an existential threat from the former president. Fewer than 7 months after the attempted coup, Brazil's Supreme Electoral Court ruled Bolsonaro ineligible to stand for office again until 2030. Interestingly, that decision wasn't even handed down as a consequence of the attempted coup itself, but of Bolsonaro's abuse of official acts to promote himself as a candidate, as well as his insistence on casting doubt without evidence on the fairness of the election. The U.S. might have done the same thing. In December 2023, Colorado's Secretary of State refused to allow Trump's name on the state's primary ballot, following the state Supreme Court's judgment that his role in the events of January 6, 2021, rendered him ineligible to run for president. Trump appealed the legality of the move, and the case came before the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices could have done what their Brazilian counterparts did, ruled that abuses of power and attempts to overturn an election were disqualifying for the highest office of the land. Instead, in March 2024, they voted unanimously to allow Trump to stand. My home country, Venezuela, faced a roughly analogous situation in 1999, when President Hugo Chavez moved to convene a constituent assembly to rewrite Venezuela's constitution, which contained no provision for him to do so. Cowed, the Supreme Court allowed him to go ahead. Venezuela's then Chief Justice, Cecilia Sosa, wrote a furious resignation letter, saying that the court had committed suicide to avoid being murdered. The result in Venezuela was the same as that in the United States. The rule of law was dead. I can't help but wish that U.S. jurists had shown the nerve of their Brazilian counterparts. In their charging documents against Bolsonaro, Brazil's prosecutors didn't mumble technicalities. They charge him with attempting a coup d'etat, which is what he did. Brazilian law enforcement didn't tie itself up in knots, appointing special counsels. The Attorney General, Paulo Genet, announced the charges himself. The conspiracy had as leaders the President of the Republic himself and his candidate for Vice President, General Braga Neto. Both accepted, encouraged, and carried out acts classified in criminal statutes as attacks on the independence of the powers and the democratic rule of law, Gonet said. Contrast that with the proceduralism at the core of the case against President Trump. After an interminable delay that ultimately rendered the entire exercise moot, Special Counsel Jack Smith charged Trump not for trying to overthrow the government, but for conspiring to obstruct the official proceeding. That would lead him to lose power, as well as conspiring to defraud the United States, a crime so abstract that only a constitutional lawyer knows what it actually means. In ruling Bolsonaro ineligible to run for office, Brazil's election court did not engage in lengthy disquisitions on 19th-century jurisprudence, as the U.S. Supreme Court did in the Colorado case. They said that he had serially abused his power, which is what he did, and which is what renders him unfit for office. This bluntness, this willingness to call a spade, was something the American Republic, for all its institutional sophistication, seemed unable to match. As recently as 2014, one would have been hard-pressed to find anyone willing to forecast that Brazil's institution would prove more effective than those of the United States at protecting democracy from populist menace. Maybe Brazilians are just more comfortable with and accustomed to holding national leaders to account. The current center-left president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, spent more than 2 years in prison for corruption after his last stint in power. Lula was ultimately freed and allowed to stand for office again when courts ruled that the judge in his initial prosecution was biased. Or maybe it was the speed of response. Rather than waiting months or years to move against the rioters who took over the country's governing institutions, the Brazilian police started jailing them and investigating the coup conspiracy almost immediately after it took place. But the biggest difference is that dictatorship is a much more real menace in Brazil, a country that democratized only in the 1980s. Then it is in a country that never experienced it. Older Brazilians carry the scars, in many cases literal ones, of their fight against dictatorship. This fight, for them, is visceral. In a way, it isn't, yet, for Americans. Brazil has demonstrated how democracies that value themselves defend themselves. America could have done the same. And that completes the article. The author, Quico Toro, is a writer at www.1percentbrighter.com and a contributing editor at Persuasion. He's based in Tokyo. And the name of his article was "Brazil Stood Up for Its Democracy. Why Didn't the U.S.?" And that completes the broadcast for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I've been reading were all published in February of 2025 in the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. Stay well, stay safe, and have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed an article you would like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio. Then on the next page, click on the Demand Podcasts. Now you'll see a page with a list of programs that are available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for there. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.